This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, people all over the world were shocked by news from Austria. According to police, a 73-year-old man named Josef Fritzl held his daughter captive in the basement of his home for 24 years and fathered 7 children with her. 3 of those children spent their lives in captivity with their mother and never saw the light of day until their release last week. Another died in infancy and was disposed of in the family furnace. Austrian prosecutors are now investigating Fritzl for rape, incest, coercion, and for the death of that one child. Rudolf Meyer, the attorney who represents Josef Fritzl, says his client has a severe mental disorder and that he's preparing an insanity defense. If Fritzl is certified insane, that could mean he would go to a psychiatric institution instead of to prison. Insanity defenses in high-profile cases always spark debate. Who can determine where responsibility ends and insanity begins? Is this just a tool lawyers use to get a better deal for their client? Later in the program, a professor in California is fired for refusing to sign a loyalty oath. She'll tell us her story. But first, the insanity defense. Should criminals deemed insane be treated differently? And where and how do we draw that line? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Dahlia Lithwick. She's the senior legal correspondent and senior editor at the online magazine Slate.com, also legal correspondent for NPR's Day to Day and for Newsweek magazine. She joins us from the studios of the University of Virginia in Richmond. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
And let's start with Austria. What do we know about this case and what Josef Fritzl has been alleged to do?
Well, I think you've pretty much summed up all the gruesome details. This daughter of his was apparently locked up in an incredibly elaborate, I read somewhere there were 8 different doors one had to access, including one that could only be opened electronically, in this dungeon for 24 years, and that he, for at least some period of that, had sex with her, I guess raped her 3 times a week, fathered 7 children, and apparently was in fact raping her in front of the children. And this went on for years and years, and only ultimately was discovered when the 19-year-old daughter was so ill that she had to be rushed to the hospital, at which point he turned himself in. So this is truly, even in, you know, on the scale of epic, horrible, horrible, gruesome stories, this one is just brain-rattling in its scope. And as you said, I think he's now facing charges of rape and incest, false imprisonment, and something called murder through failure to act if it turns out that he was involved somehow in the death of this infant who he then helped to incinerate.
Mm. His lawyer, Rudolf Meyer, says he may try the insanity defense based on what we know. Does that seem unusual?
Well, one of the things that's difficult is that we don't know, at least I don't know very much about Austrian law and how the insanity defense differs from the insanity defense here. But I think that this is fairly typical of, if you think of the kinds of folks who try to invoke the insanity defense, Neil, it really is people. It's the Jeffrey Dahmers. It's the David Berkowitz, Son of Sam. The kinds of people who do such horrific things that almost by definition they appear to be insane. And so I think it maps well onto that sort of trend of cases that are so harrowing, so gruesome, that you almost have to say, of course this person was insane, because nobody who knows right from wrong could ever contemplate such horrific acts.
Yet he hid this crime in his basement for 24 years. His wife was forbidden to go down into the basement. People who lodged at the house agreed before they did so that they would never go into the basement. Doesn't that show that he knew something was wrong down there?
Well, it's interesting, and it really goes to the heart of the conversation we're going to have about how the legal definition of insanity is quite different from the medical definition of insanity, which is in itself quite different from what you and I think are talking about, this sort of colloquial notion of what is right and wrong, and what does it mean to sort of hide your conduct, to seemingly know that what you're doing is wrong. And those things don't all actually dovetail. One of the complications in the long, long history of the insanity defense, both in this country and long before, for hundreds of years in Europe, is that it's very, very hard to get a psychiatrist, a doctor, a lawyer, and a layperson to even sit at the same table and talk about insanity in the same ways.
Let's bring the conversation a little closer to home. In this country, as you mentioned, some of the outstanding people who've tried the insanity defense, but it's widely believed that this is far more popular with television lawyers than with real ones. It's an option of last resort and rarely succeeds.
And that's such an important point, probably the most important point, because these cases tend to really churn up incredible anger and outrage, and then you see enormous sea changes in legal policy and in legislation as a consequence of these cases. The trial of John Hinckley, who was on trial for attempting to kill President Reagan, as you'll remember, he was trying to do that out of an act of love for the actress Jodie Foster. And when he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, the outcry in this country was so enormous that you'd have thought that this sort of thing happens every day. And the truth of it is, certainly the popularly cited numbers are so infinitesimal that, as you say, it only happens on TV. The study that everyone, I think, cites to when we talk about how rarely this is used is that only less than 1% of defendants actually plead insanity. And of that, only 1/4 of that 1% are ever acquitted on that basis. So this is such an inconsequential number, but I think it really, really does churn up enormous anger and outrage, a sense of terrific injustice, and as we'll probably talk about, a feeling that people fake it, that they fake insanity in order to sort of trick the system, and that's where the blowback comes in.
And the fact is, even if they get off as a result of insanity, they may end up spending more time in a psychiatric institution, which may be no bed of roses, than they might have at a prison.
That's right. Certainly the notion that people fake insanity, are acquitted by a jury, and they're out next day molesting little girls again is such a far cry from the reality. But again, I think that there's a real, some kind of visceral response that happens, that all it really takes is one John Hinckley or one Andrea Yates, the Texas mother who killed her children so horrifically, to prevail on an insanity claim. And people really clamor to get rid of it altogether.
Joining us now from New York is Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz. He's defended several clients with the insanity defense. And nice to have you back on the program.
Well, thank you so much.
You believe in the insanity defense? How come?
Believe in it. You remind me of the Baptist minister who said, who was asked, do you believe in baptism? He said, well, I've actually seen it done, of course. I've seen the insanity defense succeed. I've seen it work. In extreme cases, it certainly must continue to exist. If you have a person who's lived his whole life law-abiding and he develops Alzheimer's at the age of 80, and at the age of 85, he hugs somebody thinking that that person simply is accepting his hug and he doesn't understand his own strength and he kills him. Nobody would want his tombstone to say felon. He was a sick man who killed out of a biological medical disease. That's an extreme case, but it shows us why we must preserve some kind of insanity defense. It doesn't mean that people who commit these kinds of horrendous acts and then after the fact try to justify it by some hard to diagnose condition that sounds more like evil than it does like sickness should have the benefit of insanity defense, but we surely shouldn't abolish it.
And insanity, we should also remember, is a legal term. It's not a medical term.
Oh, it's completely a legal term. There's no medical definition of insanity, and indeed, even the statistics we heard previously have to be explained a little bit. Yes, only 1% of defendants invoke the insanity defense, and that's for a very obvious reason. The vast, vast majority of defendants who would be insane at trial are also incompetent to stand trial, so they never, ever reach the legal system. They are filtered out by incompetency to stand trial. If you have somebody who is completely out of touch, say my Alzheimer's sufferer, he would never get near a trial. He'd never be indicted. He would certainly never be prosecuted, and he would never be brought to trial. He'd be filtered out earlier and either committed to a mental hospital or some treatment facility. So when you think about those people who raise insanity defenses, they have to be people who first are found competent to stand trial, that is, pass through that barrier, and then claim that although they're now okay, they were not okay when they committed the crime. That's why it's so rare.
And when they committed the crime, they also have to admit they did it.
Well, no, they don't have to admit they did it. You can claim the alternative. You know, I didn't borrow your plate, and if I borrowed it, it was broken. If it wasn't broken, I gave it back to you. You can plead in the alternative. You can say, I didn't do it, or I didn't have the mental element to commit the crime. But if I did, I was mentally ill and insane at the time. I mean, there are cases that go both ways. There's the Hinckley case, which seems like an injustice on one side, and then there's the John DuPont case that I had something to do with on appeal that went the other way. John DuPont, a person who was so clearly and certifiably mentally ill, he killed his best friend when he honestly believed his best friend was the body of a Russian agent who was designed to come and kill him, and he killed in what he believed was self-defense. Everybody acknowledged that he was paranoid schizophrenic, but because Pennsylvania, post-Hinckley, changed its law and created a new category called guilty and mentally ill, he was found guilty and mentally ill, and as far as I know, is currently still serving his prison sentence.
There are a number of states that, I think, after Hinckley, abolished the insanity defense altogether, at least four in this country, I think.
They try to do it, but it's very hard to abolish the insanity defense because instead of raising insanity, what the defense lawyer does is raise lack of mens rea, raise kind of absence of the mental element of the crime, and try to smuggle in a kind of mental illness defense through the back door of the elements of the crime. But some states have tried to do it. The states that have been more effective have been the ones that have said, essentially, guilty and mentally ill. No irreconcilability between being essentially culpable and also mentally ill.
Alan Dershowitz, stay with us if you would. Also stay with us, Dahlia Lithwick, and we're going to continue to take your calls after we come back from a short break. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation about the insanity defense and the legal system, 800-989-8255, our email address, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After news of a horrific crime in Austria last week, we're talking through the insanity plea's many incarnations with Dahlia Lithwick. She's legal correspondent for NPR's Day Today, as well as for Newsweek and Slate. We're also talking with Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz. We want your stories as well. Should criminals deemed insane be treated differently? Where and how do we draw the line? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get Catherine on the line. Catherine's calling us from Hyde Point in North Carolina.
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Catherine.
I don't think there should be ever an insanity plea. And the reason for that is once someone pleads insanity, are they exonerated from any crime they ever commit thereafter?
Well, the answer is that they are likely to be locked up for a long, long period of time, and the only crimes they'll commit would be crimes that they commit within the institution itself. And the criteria for release is that they're no longer a danger to themselves or to others. You know, the first case that ever came up in our history for insanity, for a murder case, was an attempted assassination on President Andrew Johnson in, I think, 1832, and a man named Richard Lawrence was prosecuted by a part-time songwriter named Francis Scott Key, who was the prosecutor, and he just wanted to plead guilty or not guilty. He wanted to have a trial, and the government imposed an insanity defense on him, claiming nobody but an insane person would want to kill our popular president. And he was found not guilty by reason of insanity and spent the rest of his life in the St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital. Had he been convicted of attempting to murder Andrew Jackson, he would have only gotten, believe it or not, 6 months in prison. So sometimes pleading insanity pled for you can result in confinement for an even longer period of time than being found guilty.
Well, back to Catherine's point, you mentioned St. Elizabeth's Hospital here in Washington, D.C., where John Hinckley served a lot of his time, and he's eligible to be released should the medical authorities reach that conclusion, which I think what Catherine is talking about.
Well, that's the question. I mean, you have to be a medical authority to know, and you have to look at all the evidence, and you have to try to gradually reintegrate him. Remember that he probably would have ended up being released from prison had he been found guilty as well under our then-existing parole system. And so the question is, if he was in fact mentally ill, should he actually be punished longer than he would have been punished had he been a hitman who had been hired to do the job for a foreign government? Those are fair questions to ask.
Catherine, what do you think?
My question is this. Anyone who commits a crime under those restrictions or those guidelines has to be insane. You can't murder someone unless you're insane.
I don't believe that. Look, hitmen are in very profitable business. Hamas terrorists, others, they're not insane. They just kill because they're either paid for it or have an ideology or because they've been living with somebody for years and years and years and have built up
Again, Catherine's broader point, somebody like this man in Austria, I can't judge legal sanity or not, but I mean, is he mentally disturbed? I'm willing to stipulate to that.
Well, mentally disturbed, but you can be mentally disturbed and truly evil as well. When you look at some of the crimes that people have committed out of pure venality, you can understand that mental illness is not the only explanation for some of the most horrendous crimes unknown to human beings. Just look at the Holocaust, for example.
Catherine, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. And Alan Dershowitz, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Alan Dershowitz, a very prominent defense attorney, also a professor at Harvard Law School, and he joined us on the phone from New York City. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Kevin. Kevin with us from Hampton, Virginia.
Hi there. My comment, I actually did some criminal defense work a number of years ago, and my concern is that the application of the insanity defense in the trenches, in the cases where you don't have a lot of money for defense, it's not high profile, it's actually very disappointing. I think the people who really are very seriously mentally ill are not being given the benefit of the insanity defense in a case where it might really be appropriate to use it for them.
In other words, they can't afford Alan Dershowitz.
Well, absolutely. I was defending a woman who was very, very seriously mentally ill, and I had the court appoint a psychiatrist to examine her, and I was warned beforehand by some of the other defense attorneys that with the court-appointed psychiatrist that unless this person was, like, completely bouncing off the walls, urinating on themselves, and not able to speak coherent English, that they were going to be found competent to stand trial and likely would have an opinion rendered that they were sane at the time of the offense.
Dahlia Lithwick, do you think Kevin has a point?
I think he has a very good point if you think about the statistics we started with, which is a quarter of 1% of the folks who plead this actually prevail, and then look at the statistics of the number of people who are under the legal definition of insanity, being found competent to stand trial and then tried. I think there's a huge mismatch there, and it certainly has a lot to do both with, the ability to afford an Alan Dershowitz, and I think also this very slipperiness of our sort of mental health definition of their role in this process. I think it's worthwhile to point up that in this country alone, we've had huge waves back and forth of vast trust in the mental health profession to help guide us through these very thorny legal questions. As we said, is this person culpable? Do they know right from wrong? Were they able to control their impulses? That used to be, for a period, mid-century in the last century, there was a time when we really did defer to our mental health experts to sort that out. And shortly after the Hinckley trial, and certainly through slightly earlier than that in the 70s, we got away from that. There became a real feeling that we had deferred far too much to mental health experts, that two experts would find two different things. As the caller says, the standards were so wildly different about what mental health meant that we entrusted this to a profession that couldn't actually get the job done. And so we've really drifted back towards the original McNaughton rule that we've talked about, this ability to discern right from wrong. And even that differs from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I think there is a huge problem with both deferring too much to experts to sort out these questions and also now a system in which we perhaps don't defer enough.
Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Christopher Slobogan believes there should be a narrower definition of the insanity defense. He teaches law at the University of Florida's Levin College of Law, and he joins us now from his office in Gainesville, Florida. Nice to have you on the program today.
Good afternoon, Neil.
And how would you change the way the insanity defense is currently applied?
Well, I'm not against giving exculpatory effect to people with mental disability, but my problem with current insanity tests that, as was just mentioned, have to do with an inability to appreciate that the act was wrong or an inability to control behavior. The problem with those tests is if they're read literally, they excuse far too many people. If you take the Fitzel case, for instance, it could easily be said that he didn't appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct. He may have even thought it was okay to do what he was doing. And he might also be able to say, honestly, he felt strong urges to commit the act. But the same can be said with respect to many people who commit crimes. And it's not enough to say that most criminals do not have mental disorder, because given the broad definition of that term, many people who do horrible things can be said to have a bona fide mental disorder. So what I would do is instead change the focus of the inquiry in these cases to what the precise reasons for acting were. And so what I would do, for instance, is compare people with mental illness to people who are not mentally disabled. A person who is not mentally disabled who thinks he's acting in self-defense should have a defense. I think all of us agree with that. And I would argue so should a person with mental disability, even if it turns out that because of his delusions, he has misperceived the situation. So as is often the case, including with the DuPont case that Professor Dershowitz mentioned a little bit earlier, if a mentally ill person thinks his victim is out to hurt him, he should have a defense.
But what if he thinks, like the son of Sam, that he's getting instructions from his neighbor's dog? Somebody else told him to do it.
That, based on what I know of that case, he would not have a defense. And in fact, Son of Sam was not found insane, which I think suggests that juries are more in line with what I'm suggesting than what the literal language of the insanity test reads like. Going to the John Hinckley case as another example, there, supposedly, even if you believe the defense, his belief was that if he killed Reagan, Jody Foster would fall in love with him. Even if you believe that to be true, that's not a justifiable reason for killing someone, no matter how mentally disordered he may have been. Or the Andrea Gates case, which we all know about, the woman who drowned her five children. She was clearly suffering from schizophrenia, but if, as the prosecution alleged, she killed her children because she couldn't handle the stress of dealing with them, then she should have been found sane, not insane. Only if you believe the defense, which claimed that she killed her children so that to make sure they went to heaven rather than hell, would she possibly have an excuse under the approach that I'm advocating?
Mm-hmm. So this would narrow the application. Dahlia Lithwick, what do you think? How do you think it would change the way we see this played out in courtrooms?
I guess it's a tricky question, because trying to figure out the motives of someone like Andrea Gates seems to me so problematical. We know certainly that part of it seems almost the easiest if you're worried about fakery. It's almost easier to fake that you got instructions from your neighbor's dog. I think my own feeling is that the test, the sort of hybrid test that we have now, that both encompasses the ability to ascertain right from wrong, the original McNaughton test, with a prong of it that I think is crucial, which is this impulse control prong, the prong that says, the colloquial way of thinking about it, Neil, is if there were a policeman at your elbow, would you be able to stop yourself? And the more liberal states use that as a gloss on the original McNaughton test, the right from wrong test. It seems to me that impulse control test is another way of asking, I think, the same question, which is if you really, really know that what you're doing is wrong, but you cannot keep yourself from doing it, I'm willing to say that's also insanity. And I think that might be an easier way, or a more elegant way, of answering this, what seems to me, much more nebulous question about motive.
Christopher Slobogan, with that uncontrollable impulse, where would that fall in your definition?
Well, I have a huge problem with that test, even though I guess intuitively it makes sense to exculpate someone who really couldn't help themselves. The problem is that many criminals can credibly state that they felt very strong urges at the time they committed the offense. And that would include people, for instance, with pedophilia, as well as people with schizophrenia. In other words, this inquiry into whether someone's volitionally impaired is very difficult. And I think it's fair to say that mental health professionals would much rather deal with motives than with trying to figure out whether an impulse was irresistible or merely not resisted.
And so numerically, how much do you think that your definition would change things?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure it would change it drastically. My test would not require a person to be bouncing off the walls. It would just require that the person show that the mental disability led them to have beliefs that would lead them to think that they're about to be harmed.
And would it affect those that Professor Dershowitz said would be found incompetent to stand trial, the Alzheimer's patient?
Well, that person would clearly have a defense because in that situation, at least my understanding of those facts, the person didn't even intend to commit a crime. And, of course, a person who's not mentally disabled has a defense in that situation, so I think so should a person with mental disability. The problem is that we have these tests, but it's not clear what jurors are actually thinking about when they end up deciding a person is sane or insane. I'm not sure they pay a whole lot of attention to the precise wording of the language. Some studies suggest that all jurors are doing is deciding in their gut whether the person's crazy or not, and then they may add into the calculus the type of crime committed, and combining those two factors come up with a verdict. And a lot of times it's not really explicable given the pertinent insanity test.
Christopher Slobogan, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Christopher Slobogan teaches law at the University of Florida's Levin College of Law. He was with us today from his office in Gainesville. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Monica on the line. Monica calling us from Minneapolis.
Yes. I'm calling more sort of back a ways. You were talking about how people who are found mentally ill often end up serving more time than they would have served if they were just whipped to prison. And my brother actually committed a crime when he was 19, and that was, he's 34 now. And he is still in the hospital. He has been moved to an open hospital now. But even though they are recommending this, all the psychiatrists feel that he is ready to be released to a halfway house or a residential situation, he cannot get released because of the laws here, and I don't know how they are in other states, that a 7-judge panel has to allow them to come back, and they have to be willing to let them come back to the county where they committed the crime. And so he has now been at the top level that he can be at, has the most open privileges that they offer at the hospital, but he is not being allowed to get forward with his life.
And how much time would he have done if he just pleaded guilty?
If they had gone forward with the trial, which they didn't,
right?
He was found incompetent. He probably would have been released probably like 10 years ago on parole.
And
because it would have been because it wasn't an intentional homicide, he didn't plan it out, so it would have been like, I don't know the degrees, but he probably would have been released 10 years ago.
And the conditions in the prison, in the psychiatric institutions in which he lived,
much worse. Much worse than, because I've visited, I've visited prisons when I was in college for a sociology class, and I have visited him frequently at the security hospital. And Minnesota, I mean, we have some of the best mental institutions, I guess, in the country, and some of the best options in the country for that sort of thing. But it was very difficult for him, particularly given that he was very young when he developed his schizophrenia, and he had no familial support for it. My dad tried, but my brother ran away from him, and my mom didn't even try. So he was on his own from the time he was 14, living on the streets with this. And so it went untreated for a long time. They were actually saying that he was probably one of the most profoundly mentally ill people they had ever arrested for a crime in Minnesota.
Monica, thank you very much, and we wish you and your brother good luck.
Thank you so much.
And Dahlia Lithwick, before we let you go, as Monica suggests, the laws are very different across many, many states.
That's true. This is one of those situations where about 50% of the states do one thing, 50% do another, as I've suggested. That's changed in the last couple of decades since the Hinckley murder. So we're seeing an expansion in some states, a contraction in other, a more liberal definition in some, a more conservative in another. And I do think it all goes to this very, very complicated question of we're pretty sure that this is not good enough to just do the old McNaughton test from 1843. Does this person know right from wrong? That doesn't seem to cut it. And yet, as I've said, it's not cutting it when we defer too much to the mental health experts. It's not cutting it when we don't defer to them at all. This is such a thorny problem, and we don't seem to have a good system to resolve it. And so we're sort of seeing different things tried all over the place, but nobody seemingly very satisfied with what we've wrought.
Thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior legal correspondent and senior editor at the online magazine Slate.com, also legal correspondent for NPR's Day to Day and for Newsweek magazine, with us today from the studios at the University of Virginia. Coming up, we'll talk with a teacher in California who was fired for refusing to sign a state-required oath of loyalty, plus the trouble with enforcing loyalty oaths. That's coming up next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.